Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, an industrial project is getting pushback from residents concerned about pollution or even an explosion. We talked to the Fernandina Beach residents fighting the proposed bioethanol plant, as well as the Ryam Company officials who say it's a good deal for the small town. Later in the program, a local restaurant and music venue is an inclusive gathering place for the LGBTQ community. They share their upcoming festivities for Pride Month. But first, a proposed industrial project is causing controversy and concern in Fernandina Beach. To discuss that, we're joined by Medardo Monzon, a chemist and former president of the First Coast Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. Good morning, Medardo.
Good morning, Ann.
Also joined by Tom Budd, a Fernandina Beach resident who lives 100 yards from the site of the proposed bioethanol facility. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Ann.
In a short while, we will also hear from two senior managers at Ryam, which is formerly known as Rayonier. But first, Tom, tell us what kind of neighbor Ryam has been and what your concerns are about this proposed new facility.
Well, I think I'd start with, I knew there was a plant there when I built my house. I bought a lot that I could afford, and it was in a part of the town that I wanted to live in, just a few blocks off of Center Street, if you're familiar with Fernandina Beach. And I'm okay with having a neighbor that is the cellulose plant, the activities that I knew they were doing there. Didn't know a lot about it, but I knew enough that I was confident it was okay. That's an entirely different proposition than producing 7.5 million gallons of ethanol every year. So I started looking into that, and that's what led me to get involved with this effort to not only stop that, but to just expose how it doesn't make sense to do it.
So we should note, I mean, for people who know Fernandina or maybe don't know that well, it's sort of sandwiched between a couple of pulp factories. Mm-hmm. There's Rayonier or Ryam now to the south. There's WestRock to the north. And they've been a key part of the city's history, a key part of its economic growth and health over the years. They both opened around 1937, so they've been there a long time. They're also have been known for producing some noxious odors over the years. How has that been, and has that affected your life, your enjoyment, your quality of life there over the years? I know that people who used to complain about the smell were told it's the smell of money.
Well, the history is a little checkered, but it was long before my time on the island. The oyster beds aren't there. They used to be. That's ancient history to a degree. We're really talking about the future and what's happening, what they're trying to do now, and how that'll affect our quality of life and the safety of our residents on the island moving forward. I'm not against business. I'm not against the industrial sector. I think our country needs a robust industrial sector to protect our quality of life. But that's a different proposition than what I consider to be lunacy of building an ethanol plant this close to resident. My property, and I have many neighbors, my property is within 300 feet of the edge of the Ryam property. Now, that's not where they're going to build the ethanol plant. That would be a little deeper into their property, but that's how close I am.
The history of compliance, Medardo, for this facility, we should note, when it comes to the odors, you know, one of the contributors to that is sulfur dioxide. Both of these factories, WestRock and Ryam, produce it. Only in 2019 did this area attain compliance with 2010 Federal Clean Air Act requirements mm-hmm. when it comes to sulfur dioxide. 2019, so it was 9 years after. It took a long time to get into compliance. And a big part of that compliance was a previous project that they undertook. Tell us about what that project was, why that was helpful in reducing air emissions.
Mm-hmm. Are you referring to Lignotech?
Yes.
Okay, very good. Yes. So about 8 years ago, there was another very controversial proposal presented to the city where Rayonier would establish a joint venture with a Norwegian company to establish Lignotech, which is a company owned 45% by RYAM. The benefit of that was that RYAM would stop burning one of their byproducts that produces a lot of hazardous air pollutants, and then would ship some of that product to the new company and reducing the air emissions. At that time, I offered to the city commission to do an independent assessment of that very controversial project. And RYAM and their partner in Norway, Borregaard is the name of the company, provided me with unfettered access to their process data, to what they were doing. And my conclusion, which I presented to the city commission and to the county commission, was that that was a great project because it would reduce hazardous air pollutants significantly, as it has, and it would also create jobs. So you had the best of both worlds, you know.
And we should say that you come to this with a strong background in not only chemistry, but this kind of industry. You had done work for Dow Chemical. You worked for International Paper. And so you analyzed this plan, and basically they were going to be taking some of their waste product that they used to burn called red liquor.
Yes.
And repurpose it, not burning it.
Correct.
And
correct.
And the idea was that that would create a different byproduct they could sell, and they would be having fewer bad emissions.
Correct. And I'm glad you mentioned it, Ann, because as a 28-year veteran of the chemical and paper industry, I have a lot of respect, you know, for industry. I was part of it, and I have a lot of respect for the people that work there. But as Tom already mentioned, what they're proposing to do there, it is it's really unheard of. We have a site that contains very large quantities of already very hazardous chemicals, and to produce a very flammable material in that facility with all the dangers that it involves, I think it is. Tom used the word lunacy. I'm going to join him and use the same word.
We were talking about a proposed bioethanol project in Fernandina Beach. We invite you to join the conversation. You can call us on air at 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, and you can reach out on social media. So to return to the support that you offered previously, Medardo, to this other project, you took some heat from the environmental community because you were supporting it. It was an additional industrial project on this RYAM, or, you know, adjacent to this RYAM site.
Mm-hmm.
So somewhat increasing the city's industrial footprint, but you said it's an overall good, so you supported it.
Yes.
The dynamic has been a little different this time.
Yes, correct.
How so?
Well, excuse me. So the benefits of the Lignotech plant were pretty dramatic. A significant reduction in hazardous air pollutants with the community benefited, and also more jobs, so it strengthened the economy of the island. So terrific.
About 50 jobs?
50 to 70 jobs. I don't know exactly how many they ended up hiring. But the dynamics here are different. We have, again, a site that already processes and stores very large volumes of very hazardous and reactive chemicals. For those who are in the audience, chlorine, chlorine dioxide, ammonia, sulfur dioxide that they produce locally. So,
and those are used for RYAM's productions.
Correct. They're used today, every day. They've been used for years and years.
It's part of the pulping process where they break down the wood chips and turn it into a cellulose project.
Yes, they do. And the chlorine and the chlorine dioxide are used to bleach, you know, the cellulose. So to think that you're going to produce 7.5 million gallons a year, let me put it in perspective, Ann. It is to produce 20,000 gallons a day of ethanol in that facility with all the flammability risk that it contains. So flammability is an issue in itself, but if you have a fire in a facility which already contains all those chemicals that I talked to you about, you will produce a brew of incredibly hazardous materials that would have a significant detrimental effect on the whole community, not only the residents, but also the small business community that thrives in downtown Fernandina. So that's the biggest concern. I think it is completely inappropriate for RYAM to be proposing to build such a plant within those confines, so close to the historic district and so close to a neighborhood.
I just want to touch briefly on the timeline of this project. And so this was something that RYAM began asking for, Tom, in November. Is that right? They filed for this permit application?
For their air permit, yes.
And then the State Department of Environmental Protection reviewed that application, and they issued a draft permit.
Yes, in March.
Okay. And what happened thereafter?
Well, I had just gotten involved with learning about it. And there was a fairly robust effort in the community to organize and oppose. And I learned of it, wanted to understand the time frame for objecting to the draft air permit. And it was pretty tight. Florida DEP doesn't give you a whole lot of time to react.
What is it, 30 days?
14 days.
14 days.
And the community did react, and then it led to a petition, which I brought, asking for an administrative hearing where we can delve into the claims that RYAM has made that they can reduce pollution while creating ethanol.
And an administrative hearing is basically a kind of quasi-legal function. DEP, a judge will hear it. Basically,
yes.
On behalf of you and the people appealing, challenging this.
Yes, and we were just granted that hearing. We haven't received dates yet. It'll be sometime in the summer, we believe, late summer probably. But we do have the hearing coming up, and we're looking forward to making our case.
That's not a public hearing, is that true?
No, it's not. It's probably going to be held in Fernandina Beach, if not there, perhaps in Yulee, and if they can't find the proper facility that's open on the dates that we need, we'll end up being here in Jacksonville.
But you, as the applicant, you have to be somebody directly affected, and that's part of the reason
affected party. The actual designation in this is I'm the petitioner.
Because you live so close and
yeah.
Qualify.
Mm-hmm.
So the contents of this application, I mean, there's concerns about the flammability, and we'll talk about that, but the actual appeal that you have filed, the challenge of this air permit, has to do specifically with their claims of reducing overall emissions.
The position that we've taken, and a lot of this has come from Adardo's analysis of their application for the air permit, but the position we've taken is that their application is incomplete and therefore inaccurate in the way it presents their conclusion is that their projection is that they will reduce the pollution levels through this process. And we don't see that in their own data. Medardo could do a better job of explaining the why if you want to hear the why, but that's the issue, is we really want to get into this, and we think that Florida DEP should want to get into it, and perhaps that's why they granted the hearing.
There's really good information to get into, Medardo, in terms of what they're claiming and what you say is the actual emission level. But I want to take a couple calls that we've got on the line here. Good morning, Mark in St. Augustine. Go ahead.
Good morning. A couple of things. I'm sure one of these plants that do these, what you're suggesting, exists elsewhere in the world. And has there been, you know, any hideous explosions or any fallout from where these plants already exist? And also, I'm not exactly sure what they're producing. Is it a liquid? Is it a gas? And how will it be transported in and out? Are you going to have 5,000 trucks come through Fernandina, or is it in a big ship, or what?
That's all good questions, Mark. Medardo, let's start with the question of similar plants. There are similar plants. There are similar plants that have an ethanol component.
Yes, but a clarification here is required. And there are many bioethanol plants in the U.S., many of them have been subject of fires and explosions. The RYAM plant is very unique because there's only one other plant that I know of. It could be more, but not that many, where they produce bioethanol inside a facility that it's also a pulp mill, which contains the list of hazardous chemicals that I just mentioned. In fact, the only other plant that I know of is in France, and it's owned by RYAM. And it started production just 2 months ago.
Of ethanol.
Of ethanol, yes, in that facility. I don't know if that answers your caller's question.
And that facility in Tardis, France, before this bioethanol component was built and operating, did have a fire.
Correct. 2 years ago, they had a large fire. And one can only imagine what would have happened if, as they plan to do here in Fernandina, if they have a storage tank with nearly 40,000 gallons of flammable ethanol in that facility.
So to be clear, the bioethanol, there are ethanol plants. They have been the subject to fires in the past, but this is a unique combination where the adjacent facility has a lot of really hazardous chemicals as well.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. We got a call from Eric in Arlington. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I'm currently living on the west side. I bought a house over there about 20 years ago, and I'm about a quarter of a mile from what I refer to as a poison factory. They manufacture cosmetics there. But the thing is, I guess the relevant things are every Friday at like 3:30, you can stand outside the exhaust vents at this factory, and they're blasting out something that smells like hairspray. I mean, it's going all out in the atmosphere. And the important part of all this is there is a elementary school, I mean, less than a half mile as the crow flies from this facility. What is the thinking there? I mean, how do we end up in these? Is this just a Jacksonville thing or what?
What is the facility, Eric?
I can name it. I can say what it is.
Yeah, sure.
It's Colomer. They make Revlon. They make, you know, poison. They make, you know, like mascara and stuff that ends up in the water, you know, conditioner for your hair, so on and so forth, stuff that ends up in the water, poisoning the water. And, you know, it's all stuff that human beings don't even need to begin with. I mean, it would be a point of pride for me if in my neighborhood there was a plant that manufactured solar panels or something.
Have you ever filed any complaints, I mean, in terms of odor complaints with the city or with the state regulatory department, DEP?
I have not, but maybe I should do that. The thing is that concerns me is the elementary school.
Sure.
Because, you know, in neighborhoods like mine, it's the 32254, probably the poorest zip in town. You know, you have little kids going to school, and we don't know what, you know, the causes of autism are yet. There's a lot of like illnesses out there running around.
Sure.
We're not sure exactly what causes them. And here we got this poison factory a half mile away from an elementary school. It just seems okay.
Thanks, Eric. I mean, it's obviously we don't know what emission he is talking about, mm-hmm. but I will say, Medardo, that in terms of trying to figure those things out, you're a chemist, you're able to parse these, you know, permit applications and their permits, but ordinary people, they're really impenetrable.
Very difficult. All these air permits, as people would know, they are very lengthy documents. They're very, very complicated. And they require a good knowledge of chemistry, which not many people have. And then you also need to involve physicians, because now I can estimate and I can analyze what the chemistry of the air pollutants, but not the impact on health, which most of them are, or many of them are, hazardous and toxic. So, yes, the community needs to pay attention and needs to be questioning. And
would you have any advice for someone like Eric to figure out what exactly that emission is that's blowing into his neighborhood?
Probably implement some monitoring of the air quality around it. You know, they're very sophisticated monitors these days that can analyze what's coming out. Also, the suggestion would be to request a copy of the air permit of that facility, and you know, to determine if it's in compliance with the air permit or not, and then take action accordingly.
So, as I mentioned, we are going to be hearing from a couple of RYAM managers in just a minute or two. I spoke to them previously, but before that, I want to get into the assertions that are made in this air permit.
Yes.
And what you have found to be inaccuracies, or what you believe to be inaccuracies, Medardo. So what is it about the current emissions that they're citing that you believe is inaccurate?
Okay. So first and foremost, the facility, it's already a recognized producer of hazardous air pollutants that are very well regulated. And there are typically four that I've mentioned before. So the RYAM has submitted annual reports to the FDEP on the emissions that come out of the combined site. And it's important for people to know that the FDEP looks at the Lignotech and RYAM site as one in terms of air pollutants. They file those reports, and those are very serious reports that they file with the FDEP. So I believe those reports is their own data. In the air permit application, they also submit data which shows what they project to be the air emissions once the bioethanol plant is built, if it's eventually built. And what their own data would show, without getting into the details, is that the air pollutants will grow, or the emissions of hazardous air pollutant will increase. A couple of points here that are relevant, Anne. They will increase to such a point that they exceed what the regulatory agencies call thresholds. So it means that if the emissions exceed that amount, let's say 10 tons, then a subsequent review, a more detailed review, is required to prevent a deterioration of air quality. Their own data shows that the emissions of three of those hazardous air pollutants will exceed those thresholds, those deteriorating the quality of the air that we breathe in Fernandina.
And we should be clear, when you're saying their own data, you're talking about the annual data they submit to DEP,
correct,
not the information that's included in the air permit request.
When you compare both, okay, the annual reports that they have submitted from 21 to 23 show what those emissions have been. The projected air emissions in their air permit show what they expect the air emissions to be. Those projected air emissions, their own data show, will exceed those thresholds.
Exceed the current ones.
The current ones, correct.
And explain how that is, because you believe they're using a different baseline than the current emission data that they have to submit annually to DEP.
Correct. I understand that the regulatory agents would allow this, and we're going to challenge that. Is the baseline in the air permit is data from 2014, 2015. And basically the implication is that Lignotech does not exist, that those emissions didn't decrease. So our position is that RYAM knows what happened. In fact, in their open house that they held in March, they showed how those emissions had decreased. And so the baseline data in the permit that they use is old data and does not represent what the air quality is today.
And so they built Lignotech with the goal of, and as you say, the effect of reducing emissions, but the application that they've submitted for this new project basically uses the pre-Lignotech emission data.
Correct.
And they're permitted to do that by state law. They can use up to 10 years of prior data. Is that true?
That's my understanding, although I think that can be questioned and challenged because of the changes that occurred about 6 years ago once Lignotech started.
I want to take a couple of calls. We have an anonymous caller from Mandarin. Good morning. Go ahead.
Yes. So I live near Preferred Materials on Greenland Road and Phillips Highway, and they are constantly blanketing out smoke, and they're sending out these horrible smells of like asphalt and other like horrible things. And it's right down the street from Greenland Pines Elementary, and it's always right next to like a African-American neighborhood. And I personally complained to the city and to the EPA. I even sent a video in where they had blanketed the whole street in like this dusty black soot, and my roof is covered in it. Everyone's cars is covered in it, and no one cares. The city doesn't do anything. They're like, well, when we came out there, it wasn't doing that.
Thanks for the call. There's limits on, I don't know how many people the city can send out for those incidents. They are not necessarily staffed up to do it in a timely fashion, and that's true. I want to take a quick call. Lynn from the Beaches, just briefly.
Yes. 2 years ago, my husband was diagnosed with a fragrance allergy. We didn't know. We burned a lot of candles in our home. They have an ingredient called balsam of Peru. He had burns on his arms and legs that looked like he'd been in a fire. It took a Harvard dermatologist to diagnose it, all from the smell of candle burning. So I'm going to make a big leap here. And if you are putting toxic chemicals in the air, I think there's a lot of potential danger to our health. And it needs to be investigated and looked at. Thank you.
Thanks, Lynn. I do want to get to the interview that I did with two RYAM executives yesterday. I spoke to RYAM senior project manager Mark Homans and RYAM senior biomaterials and environmental manager David Rogers. This is a little over 10 or 11 minutes. Let's take a listen. Mark Homans and David Rogers, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So to start off, there are some things that we are not going to talk about today. Air pollution, that component in particular. Why don't we explain for the purpose of our listeners why that is?
Sure. Thank you for the opportunity. RYAM as a company just doesn't speak about pending litigation, so I appreciate your understanding of that, and that's as it relates to the air construction permit. But we're happy to speak with you about the rest of the project.
Okay. And so people are clear, there's an air permit. It's been challenged by some folks in the community via an administrative hearing process, and that is essentially a kind of litigation in the eyes of RYAM.
That's correct.
Okay. But there's a lot of things that we can talk about. We did want to talk to you about what we can talk about. So first of all, where are we in terms of design? What stage are we at?
Yeah, I'd be happy to take that. So it's early. It's still in the development phase. So the engineering phase where we're developing the cost and the economics and, you know, taking input, obviously, from a lot of different sources, but it's still very much in the development phase.
And so to be clear about what that means, I know that the RYAM CEO spoke to a Wall Street analyst and said it was in a detailed engineering phase. Is that different from kind of an early stage engineering phase?
That's correct. So there's really a conceptual engineering phase and there's detailed engineering. That's correct. So we're in that phase.
Okay. And so given that you're at that phase, are you able to answer basically the questions that the community has about various potential impacts?
Yes, most of them, as there's details available at this point in time. There's some, unfortunately, we just don't have that level of detail yet.
Okay. I mean, I think it's fair to say the community has, as our program is discussing, doesn't feel like it's getting maybe all of the answers that they expect or want.
Yeah, maybe I take that one, Mark. Sure. I can just speak to you about what we have done so far from a communication standpoint. We have, as you all did do as I entered the room earlier today, was you have a community advisory board. Well, we have a community advisory board. So we first introduced this project to our community advisory board and just let them know what we were doing and what the conceptual plans were.
And who comprises the board?
Various community leaders. It's been in place since, I think, 1999 is when we first started that meeting, just to get feedback from the community. We hold it twice a year. You know, I've been with the company here in Fernandina 17 years, so I've been going to it, I guess that's 34 times I've been to the community advisory. And it's a good forum for feedback and a good way that we're able to connect with the public and understand the concerns.
Mm-hmm.
So we opened with that, and then we then held a public meeting back in March of this year where we connected with over 170 people in the community and discussed the project. We had about 24 of our engineers and scientists and had different booths set up all the way from what the mill does to what this potential process does. And we answered every question that anybody had for about 3 hours.
So I'm going to ask you about that setup. I've been to those kind of briefings before, the science fair style.
Sure.
And there are people available to answer specific questions, but it does dilute the kind of community voice, if you will, an opportunity for people to hear what their neighbors are questioning you about and getting those answers and then possibly thinking of important follow-ups. Is that is that the most effective way for the community to feel like it's getting its questions answered? Or do you think that there is a need for a more, a fuller forum where people are hearing one another?
Well, certainly there has been and there will be. Because what we took from that meeting was detailed conversations, one-on-one, one-on-two conversations with a lot of people to understand what they understood. But there were 170 of people in the audience, and you know we're a couple dozen. So we then took people's phone numbers and cards from particular people who had them, and we followed up with each person individually. Any person who had a question on that on our process following that, we either met with them over the phone or met with them on the front porch, as we did one of our newer residents nearby.
And I'm if I may just
sure.
add the fact that Fernandina is still a small town at heart. And so with Dave and I, with over 50 years of experience, you know, combined in terms of living and working in this community, we're very, very close to the community. And so whether it's in Publix or on the soccer field or even walking my dog, we get questions about it. So we have a longstanding history of being totally ingrained in the community, and we're open to questions. And we do listen, and we learn, and we adapt.
The commission, the city commission, had a meeting after your meeting in March, and I believe it was the vice mayor who said there weren't, you know, it's early in the process, so there's probably not a lot that they can answer at this point, but that there were a lot of people that didn't feel like they had the answers that they needed. And that was after that meeting at a commission meeting. Mm-hmm. Does that surprise you that that was the takeaway?
Again, some people, these are all good people, right? They're going to have their opinions, and whether or not they think the answers were sufficient or not is up to them. But we continue to get information out. We continue to have presentations, but again, only sharing the details that we have today. So it would be improper for us to speculate on something we haven't yet proposed, let's say to the city, for instance. So it's important. We understand there's a lot of interest, but again, it is still early.
In terms of opposition, Mark, one person that's been vocal is Medardo Monzon. He has been critical of this project, but a few years ago, he was really quite collaborative with RYAM and its efforts with the Lignotech project. Mm-hmm. He took a lot of heat from the environmental community for the position that he took, which was he thought it was a good thing. He thought the science spelled a reduction in pollution. And he provided a report that was key for the city and the county's buy-in on that project to some extent. Why do you think he's so opposed to this project?
Well, first, I would characterize the feedback as being very balanced. Honestly, there has been a lot of positive related feedback to the project. And generally, I think most people consider this environmentally friendly, right? But there are concerns, and so we're hoping to address them. I think the fact that we have worked with Medardo in the past just goes to show you that we do this, right? We reach out as there are opportunities to connect with the community. I can't speculate on where Medardo is coming from, you know, in this case. But we are happy to share with you, though, the positive aspects of the project.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that. But I want to talk about a few of the specific concerns that have been raised. And one big one is flammability, partly because ethanol is a flammable substance, but also because there are some extremely hazardous chemicals on site there at the sulfite mill, at the pulp mill, including chlorine dioxide, ammonia, sulfur dioxide, chlorine. Those are things that can be combustible but unpredictable in terms of how they would react with each other. And what is the planning for any potential fire, you know, catastrophic level fire?
That's a good question. I appreciate the question there. I would start with being a general manager in the last 5 years before my current role here. Safety is the utmost importance, especially for our employees, right, and their families who also work in this community. So they're on the forethought of our mind in terms of safety concerns. We have a very rigorous process, including a process safety management program, which one of the key aspects of that is where is the site located? So we took that into consideration, and we've located this facility that is at a safe distance away from the rest of the process and the community. And it's in a place such that it's on elevated ground. It's outside of the floodplain. And so it's very important to start with that. And then beyond that, you get into the engineering of that facility. And so it's subject to lots of regulations, engineering codes and standards. The insurance overrider actually provides a lot of input as well into fire safety in particular. And so as we're going through detailed engineering, it's important to understand some key elements that the site will have containment, concrete floors and walls. We fully expect it'll have fire detection systems, automated and dedicated fire suppression systems, as well as training, obviously, for those employees that are involved. We also maintain an on-site emergency response team on a 24/7 basis, so they will certainly be trained on this aspect.
How large is that team?
It's about a dozen people per shift. But beyond that, though, we've initiated conversations with our local emergency officials, including both chiefs of the city and the county. And so we've only shared preliminary plans with them, but we are fully prepared to engage them in that so that we can further develop what those plans look like.
And so because of the chemicals that you have on site, you are required to do some reporting and some planning with regulators. And some of that involves a kind of worst case scenario look at what could happen if something leaked or broke, you know, with one of the chemicals. Even in a small incident where something failed, there is a worst case scenario that requires has a large footprint of an impact of a mile or so. Are you forecasting what could happen in that space were something to be added to that, like a fire circumstance, as opposed to just a leak of a existing hazardous chemical?
Well, I think I'll go back to the point about the facility siting. That's why that is so important, is the proximity to other things, as you mentioned. So it's very important that it's outside of the proximity of other things, right? So we're really focused on the fire hazard in particular. And so we're working scenarios as it relates to that. Again, that's when you've got these layers of engineering controls, administrative controls, and you do plan. You plan for incidents, right? So you have an emergency response plan, and we fully expect to do that.
Ethanol has got some benefits. It is being essentially a recycled product here. It's going to be producing a fuel. Are there benefits to the community in terms of jobs? Is there something tangible that comes with this project that some consider a little bit of a risky proposition?
Sure. I'd be happy to start and talk about the benefits in general. So I appreciate you asking. So it first starts with the sugars, right? They're accessible in our process, which is really interesting. So we're starting from fermentation, starting that biological process and separation through distillation. And so at the end of the day, it is an alcohol, right? It is flammable, and we understand that. but it is a large capital investment as well. And so there's economic benefits for that. For 85 years, there's been studies that have shown the industry on the island has about 20% of the GDP on the island. So it is important. It's important to the future of the Fernandina plant and the employees that work
there. Not necessarily new jobs.
There are some. There are some prepared for that.
If I could add one to the benefits column of the project, you know, the world is calling out for more sustainable fuel sources. And this is really a critical component of a sustainable fuel mix. The carbon intensity of the type of ethanol that we're producing, second generation, is only about 20% of that of gasoline. And we see it as all of our benefits, all of our responsibility to lean into more sustainable solutions at a facility like ours, which does have a substantial footprint.
I want to ask you, because speaking of the fermentation process, you know, there's some of these sugars that can be broken down with regular yeast, some that require a genetically modified version of that yeast. Right. What's going to be done with that product after that process?
With respect to the yeast?
With respect to the GMO yeast.
Yeah, a decision has not been made whether it's GMO or regular yeast at this point. But in either case, what happens is the same, as it gets recycled back into our process and then ultimately burned in our recovery furnace.
So I guess my final question is, what is planned in terms of future community engagement on this?
Well, let me also add too, because we haven't yet touched, if you don't mind, on the local emissions benefit. And the bottom line, simple truth, is that we will no longer be burning the sugars. And we cannot add any new fossil fuel, because in order to qualify this facility to participate in second generation, it cannot add to the carbon footprint. So that's a really important point I wanted to make sure that we got across. But we fully expect, when we do have a proposal, is that we will engage the city in terms of applying for a building permit. So all of those plans will be shared at that point. But we continue to do other presentations. We continue to do one-on-one conversations. Again, we're out in the community. We're constantly having conversations because there's so much interest in this. But I think the common ground with everybody is that we're all aligned on this is it's a good environmental project. And we recognize their concerns, and we're listening.
Well, Mark Homans, David Rogers, thanks so much for being here.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, man.
All right. So that was a couple of the planners, the project managers of this RYAM proposal. I just asked Tom for your takeaways on those comments.
A couple. First off, I went to that open house that they had, and Dave Rogers' comment about meeting with residents and on their front porch, that was me. I invited them over to my home so I could talk about this project.
I didn't want to oppose it, but what I've learned is I have to oppose it. And the example that I think makes the most sense, they talked about second generation bioethanol. It's a better product. There's no, well, it's a new product in most respects, but it appears to be a better way to go. It's just not something you should be producing here. An example, if you wanted to produce fireworks, you wouldn't do it next to a school. Well, basically, that's what they're doing with ethanol. There are schools, churches, businesses, an historic downtown, and many residences that are neighbors of this plant. Think about how do you get permits and permission to do that today on a barrier island with limited escape routes? It just makes so little sense for anyone other than RYAM, because they're able to make more money. And I'm a profit guy. I've been a business guy and an entrepreneur all my life. I like profit. That's how the world runs. So I'm not against that. It's just a foolish place to do it.
I want to just briefly touch on the city's involvement. We should note that we reached out to the city attorney, the city manager, the mayor of Fernandina Beach. We invited all of them to participate. They did not choose to participate. But it's worth noting, Medardo, that the mayor works at RYAM.
Yes.
Has that had any impact on your requests for a fuller discussion of this at the city commission level?
Yes, it has. The city commission is comprised of five city commissioners. Two of them have requested a public review of the project in front of the community. And basically, it has been torpedoed by the mayor, who lately used the argument that he's recusing himself from doing that. But in recusing himself, he's avoiding having a presentation made to the public. So yes, there has been.
And that actually came to a vote at one point. Is that right? They voted down the idea of asking RYAM to come and do a presentation.
Correct. I know Tom, myself, several other citizens have gone in front of the city commission systematically, periodically requesting that review, which has yet to happen.
We only have a little bit of time. There is a comprehensive plan for the city. They did a review recently that found that this would not comport with that plan, that it wouldn't adhere to it, this industrial project. And so that is something that is still outstanding. Is that correct?
It is. We had our attorney who filed a petition with Florida DEP offer us an outside legal opinion, and it was clear that it does not work within the comp plan or the LDC, Land Development Code. And then the city's own outside legal opinion said the same thing. It's clearly not a permitted use. We'll see where that goes from here.
Well, it's an issue that we will stay abreast of. Thanks so much for coming down from Fernandina to talk about it today. Tom Budd, Medardo Monson, thank you so much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Up next, the importance of queer spaces and upcoming Pride Month events.
Next Electro Lounge, we've got Eric Hilton, Yousef Days, and so much more. I'm David Luckin. End your week in a good place at the Electro Lounge, Saturday at 10, only on WJCT News 89.9.
AARP Florida. During hurricane season, AARP offers free resources for older adults and their loved ones. Floridians can find the tips and tools they need to prepare, respond, and recover. Details at aarp.org/FLDisasterHelp.
North Florida TPO, proud sponsor of WJCT's First Coast Connect, bringing to the community innovation in transportation planning, commuter services, clean fuels, and intelligent transportation systems. More at northfloridatpo.com.
Hi, this is Tom Hudson. Every Friday on the Florida Roundup, you can expect discussion, not disinformation.
Hi there, I'm a family therapist.
This is a First Amendment violation.
Revelations, not empty rhetoric.
today I just found out that I was eligible for $23 a month in food stamps.
And even some surprises.
Dr. Brown, you helped deliver my baby, and I owe you my life.
Wow.
It's the Florida Roundup, Fridays at noon.
Tech jobs are becoming more scarce across the country. So what does that mean for up-and-coming tech hubs?
If we can't find these great folks a good way to make money in St. Louis, they will either change their industry or they will change their town.
I'm Amy Scott. That story next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6 on WJCT News 89.9.
President Biden takes action on the border.
To protect America as a land that welcomes immigrants, we must first secure the border and secure it now.
What the Biden administration is doing by restricting asylum, who's affected, and how it plays into the president's political calculus. That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
And we're back. Once safe havens for queer people, LGBTQ plus bars and clubs are slowly vanishing. One local venue is hoping to fill that gap with inclusive programming for all. I'm joined now by Alexander Eli, the co-owner of The Walrus and a musician. You just heard his song, Come to Love, released under his project Daddy. Hey, Alexander.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Very good. And BB Deluxe, artist and musician and founder of Duval County Queer Pride at The Walrus.
That's the one.
Welcome. Thank you for being here, BB.
I'm happy to be here.
Okay, so LGBTQ plus bars and clubs have been disappearing. There have been a number of studies, a book that recently came out that found that 40% have closed basically since pre-pandemic times. What your thought as to why that's happening?
I think there's numerous factors. I think venues in general are closing. A lot of that has to do with pandemic. A lot of that has to do with out-of-town investors who want to tell the community what they have instead of enjoying what the community has. But more than that, we like to focus on the queer bars that are existing. People just forget about them, or they think that they're inevitabilities. And I think that there's an inherent need for queer people to gather in a space together and celebrate surviving in a world that doesn't always let them do that.
So there have been, you know, some discussion of like whether pop-up clubs have also impacted, you know, nightclub life for the LGBTQ community, Alex, or whether, you know, the existence of apps have given people an opportunity to meet and socialize outside of a club setting.
I think there's still a really desperate need for third spaces, especially for queer third spaces. For third spaces that are offering to be not a safe space, but a brave space. And I think that term is definitely something that's new that's come across the scene, where it's these concepts of, say, disappearance of clubs. I do think there's a compact of economics there, because when you think about, when I think about as a business owner, the issues I have running a small business, and then you add the impacts of being a trans person in the state of Florida, just trying to navigate my life, the personal strain that the politics can put on business owners can be really impactful. And I think a lot of the reasons that clubs tend to tap out is running a club is nonstop, whether it's LGBTQIA plus or for straight people. And if you don't have a system in terms of the politics to support these third spaces, especially for queer people in oppressive states, I mean, it kind of feels like I don't know why it's a surprise to people that these places are disappearing. There's no, like, even in the city of Jacksonville, there's no grant funding for queer spaces to exist. There's really not funding for cultural spaces to exist outside of the urban core or the DVI borders, because all that money wants the downtown investment money to come downtown to build the urban core. But Jacksonville is a huge city, and so there's so many more spaces outside of downtown Jacksonville that also need those dollars. And I do think third spaces, when I say third spaces, I mean spaces that community can gather, and the queer community needs those spaces because traditionally there has been no other place to go.
Explain what the difference is between a safe space and a brave space.
A brave space is saying that we want to offer more than safety to you. We acknowledge that you're brave for being here and that you deserve more than safety. You deserve equity, and you shouldn't feel like you have to escape the world, that we acknowledge that you're brave for just being in it in the first place.
And we should say that Walrus is located in Murray Hill, so it is outside of the downtown core, but it has become a real resource for the community. And there are a number of events that are, you know, that, that Walrus is hosting and offering this month in some ways to make up for the closure of other places around the city.
You could say that.
What's lined up?
Well, on Friday, June 21st, we have the Mixed Walrus Pageant, which is a gender-neutral drag pageant. On Saturday, June 22nd, we have a theatrical drag experience of Meme Girls, which was our triple sold-out parody of Meme Girls. We have Hoedown on Friday, June 28th, which, do you want to talk about that, Alex?
Hoedown.
First of all, the spelling. It's H-E-A-U-X, right?
Yeah, you know, no. like Foho.
Foho,
yeah,
okay.
There you go.
Not gonna get us.
Not gonna get us, baby. We ain't getting in trouble.
This is like a country music?
Yeah, I was deeply inspired by the work of Stacey Bennett and the Queer Country Disco that they formed and now have, what I think it's 5 years running. It feels like it's something that the community has always needed. I mean, we live in the South. People love country music. So I took that model of doing a country event, and since I had a country project, Hoedown was started in partnership with Plan C as a sex-positive honky-tonk for your badonkadonk to raise money for the Florida Access Network, which is the longest-running abortion access fund in the state of Florida.
The idea with Queer Country Disco and with this project is that there are a lot of people that enjoy country music, particularly in this region, but that hasn't always felt like a safe space for people who are non-gender conforming.
No.
It is not.
It's not. Country music in the South, and I can say that as someone who's worked in venues for 10 years,
oh, yeah.
I've been told by some of my past bosses, which we won't say those names, but that if I didn't feel safe at those shows, I could just not work them.
I mean, I don't know if you can tell by the sound of my accent and the twist of my front teeth, but I love country music.
Yeah, and I love country music too, but there is this thing where, like, to see country music, you watch people take an AK to Bud Light because they're mad at Pride sponsorships, and then saying like country bangers behind it, as opposed to saying that being queer isn't American or being queer is like the opposite of what this culture and this country really stands for.
Well, there are a ton of issues that surround this, but the Pride events that you guys are hosting and proposing, I think, are going to be a big part of the celebration this month. So thank you.
Drag Fest, Saturday, June 29th, and Queer Fest, Sunday, June 30th.
Thank you, BB. Thank you for being here, Alexander, Eli, both of you. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And that's our program. Join us tomorrow when our First Coast Week in Review panel discusses the week's headlines, from a new superintendent contract to the sentencing of a convicted school teacher. I'm Ann Schindler, and you've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.